It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. If you've ever had a burning desire to pursue a career in law enforcement, especially as a state trooper, there may be no better time to do so than the present. The Pennsylvania State Police are down 400 positions and anticipate hundreds of additional vacancies next year. But for a variety of reasons, getting people to even consider a career as a trooper has proven to be a challenge. Why are applicants down, and how can the state police attract more candidates? I'm joined now in studio by Corporal Brian Carpenter of the Pennsylvania State Police. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
If you have a comment or question, you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is essspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at ESSPGH. These are prestigious jobs with good pay. So why, Brian Carpenter, are state police applicants down?
I believe there's a variety of reasons. One, we're battling right now social media, the things that you see that are going on out there. We also, in years...
Okay, I'm going to stop you there because I'm not sure. What are you seeing? What's happening with social media that would impact this?
A lot of things that you're seeing, some of the events that have been unfolding across America, as far as, you know, how police are viewed in the public. And I think that sometimes even the good people say, I don't know if I'm willing to go ahead and make the sacrifices that it takes to become a Pennsylvania State Trooper or in law enforcement in general.
So what's happening in Ferguson, for example, or Baltimore, the reaction to those situations involving police community relations, regardless of who's on what side and who's right and who's wrong, you're saying that is having an impact on recruiting people to become state troopers?
I believe it does. I think a lot of people aren't, like I said, not willing to make that sacrifice and be put under the scrutiny a lot of times that we're seeing right now. It's a different age than I'm 13 years on the job, and it's definitely evolved and changed quite a bit since I've come on.
Well, there's the scrutiny and there is also the danger, and we've seen that in the past year, unfortunately, as well. And I'm guessing that impacts it, too.
Yes, sir, absolutely. We have had 96 troopers killed in the line of duty to date, unfortunately.
Is it simply a matter of less people wanting a career in law enforcement, or is there, besides some of the social media, conversations that are happening, is there something else at play here? People years ago really aspired to these types of careers. Is there some other factor that's come into play that for whatever reason has affected the prestige of these jobs?
I don't believe it's affected the prestige. We're the first state police agency of its kind in the country. It's a very prestigious job to have. I just think that a lot of times people don't think about being a police officer first and foremost. And years ago, we had a lot of people that were working in the mills and the mines and things like that, and they would go to come over. Applications dropped off significantly after we installed the college requirements.
And what are those?
You have to have 60 college credits in any field of study from an accredited institution. And the any field of study is very important because a lot of people think that, I have to study criminal justice or criminology to be a trooper. And that's not the case. You can study anything. For example, my degree is in education.
So if you have let's say you got a full four-year college degree, a bachelor's degree of some kind, how does that weigh against having some previous law enforcement experience or specific training in a junior college program or a college program?
Really, it doesn't matter. Our process, you might want to say, is almost blind. Whereas we look at to see, are you a United States citizen? Are you at least 20 years old to apply, 21 before you can go to our academy? Are you appointed to the academy prior to age 40? But for the education, it's 60 college credits, and it doesn't matter. If someone comes in and they have a doctorate degree or they have 10 years with a large police department and experience, that doesn't matter. In the process, there's a written exam and an oral interview. If you pass the written, you move on to the oral. We combine those scores, and we rank our applicants. And from there, everybody gets pulled forward, and the rest of the process is all pass-fail. So it's all based on, it's all against yourself. There's a physical readiness test, polygraph background, psychological, medical. And that's the process there.
What are the intangibles that you're looking for? For example, you know, when it comes to the psychological test, you know, what are the state police looking for from an applicant?
I mean, obviously, we're looking to make sure that the people are stable and competent. It's a huge responsibility to be entrusted to go out and protect the public, and the tools that they give us to go out there in our trade, you have to be able to, you know when to use them and know how to process things. So that's one of the big things. Probably the biggest intangible is, and I tell people this all the time, being a good person is the first and foremost thing. We can get anyone to get their 60 college credits. We can get them through the physical readiness test, things like that. But making good choices throughout your life and being able to go through the background in a polygraph, which is intense, that's probably the biggest thing.
What kind of questions might come up on a polygraph test?
Just about anything you can think of, drug use, theft.
Did you cheat on your taxes, that kind of thing?
Yes, absolutely. They're going to ask you just about everything because we want to find out what kind of person you are, and to make sure that we're hiring top quality folks, because the job that we have to go out there and protect the public, you need to make sure that you're testifying in court, you're swearing on an affidavit that this person did what you're charging them with, and we have to make sure that people are beyond reproach.
And what about the physical part of the exam? What kind of shape are you looking for somebody to be in?
Well, we're looking at folks to be in very good shape. However, the standards, whenever you look at them online, are very deceptive. For instance, 13 push-ups, no time limit.
13?
Yes.
Okay. I think I could do that.
there you go. A mile and a half in 17 minutes and 48 seconds.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I think so. It's not that high of a bar, really, for the physical part of this.
Not to get on the job. However, at the academy is a lot more challenging than people think. And so, you have to be prepared, because after you get there your first day, you do the PT test again. Nobody asks you to do 13 push-ups anymore. We're not walking our mile and a half. You're out there training every day in all kinds of weather. Every morning we're doing a morning run or some sort of PT, physical activity. When you go into the gym, I mean, we box in the gym. We still do handcuffing. You might do calisthenics in the gym for an hour prior to going into ground defense or boxing. So you really have to be in shape. And I think that catches a lot of people. They see those standards and how the bar is set very low, and they don't realize and prepare appropriately for when they get to the real challenging portion.
So don't show up if you do apply and you get accepted to the to go through the academy, don't expect to work yourself into shape once you're there. You better do something prior to showing up.
Oh no, absolutely. And we tell people that whenever we go to the physical readiness test, that's really the first face-to-face contact that I have with folks that have chosen not to meet with a recruiter. And we explain to them that what you're doing today is not going to be anything near what we're going to require you to do at the academy.
So you better get off your couch if you're serious about applying for this. And we're talking about the openings. There are a number of them, hundreds of them, at the for the Pennsylvania State Police, who are looking to fill a variety of positions for a variety of reasons. People, for whatever the reason may be, specifically to their case, are choosing not to consider a career as a trooper, and it's been a challenge to try and recruit people to fill these positions, which are only going to increase as we go forward. With us in studio is Corporal Brian Carpenter of the Pennsylvania State Police. If you have a comment or question, if you want to join the conversation, if you're interested or thinking, hey, I might like to try this, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. We're also taking your email questions at esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. We have an email question from Josh. Given the shortage of troopers, might we expect to see a decrease in the standards required to become a trooper? And as I understand it, some of those have been relaxed. So is Josh's question pertinent here?
Well, we're not going to sacrifice the standards in order to increase the number. There are plenty of good people out there, and we have to find them. So that means we're going to have to work harder. So I don't see standards being decreased in order to try to fill these gaps.
So there's nothing that's being done to ease the requirements for some of, in some cases for recruits?
A couple of the things that we have done, which isn't lowering the standards, we have incorporated a military waiver. So 4 years of active duty with an honorable discharge, military folks no longer have to have the college requirement. Same thing for law enforcement. So those aren't decreasing our standards. It's just there's a waiver there, and these folks bring lots of skills that they get outside of being in a college environment.
Did the need for more troopers increase as more municipalities opted to disband their police departments in favor of state police patrol?
That, and for several years, we just didn't get the number of people. We had more people retiring than we were authorized to hire in the budget, and that kind of created the gap started to widen over the years, and now we're really starting to feel the crunch.
And how can the state police attract more candidates? What are some of the things that, if you know, assuming that there are some people who are considering this as we have this conversation, listening in, what do you think is important for them to know? And what is the state police doing to get people interested?
Well, we have 9 full-time recruiters throughout the state. And a lot of people don't realize that we have full-time people that are out there. We travel around the state talking to folks all the time, explaining what we do. And it's important, I think, that people realize that we're not a highway patrol. We're a full-service police department. We're the 10th largest department in the country.
So if you're not just a highway patrol, it means you're doing other things. What are they?
I like to say we're the police where there are no police. And what I mean by that is, if you do not have a city or a municipal police department that services the area that you live, then when you call 911, the Pennsylvania State Police will come out and provide that service. So we're a full-service police department, and we do everything that there is in law enforcement.
And the other things might include what? For example, I think you have a lot of undercover work that people might not realize that state troopers do.
Absolutely. Probably one of the biggest things that people ask me about is getting into criminal investigations or becoming a detective. We have a lot of people that do that, but we have about 100 or so different specialty jobs. So from working undercover for like Vice, doing things such as drug work, prostitution stings, things like that. We have polygraph operators. We have canines. We have helicopters, airplanes, motorcycles, a SWAT team. We have people that work in forensic services that go out and, you know, do like they people see that on CSI. But those are actual troopers. They're not civilians that go out and process all these scenes. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. So there's a lot of other opportunities that I don't think people associate with the Pennsylvania State Police when they look at it as being more like a highway patrol, which is not accurate.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation with State Police Corporal Brian Carpenter, who is with us here in studio. 412-246-2002. Let's go to Robin in Monroeville. Robin, hi. You're on Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi.
Good morning or good afternoon.
Good morning.
Go ahead with your comment or question for Corporal Carpenter.
I was curious about the starting pay and the retirement benefits for anyone who applies for the job.
Well, the starting salary is going to be $57,251.
Starting salary.
Yes, that's after graduation from the academy. And as far as retirement goes, now you're hearing a lot of things about pension reform out there. But currently, we can retire after 20 years or 25 years with no age penalty. So in 20 years, you get 50% of your highest year, and at 25 years, you get 75% of your highest year.
And we understand, too, that and Robin, stay on the line because I wanted to ask you, but you mentioned the pension situation. There's a waiver. I think even the governor, or excuse me, the Republicans in the legislature who have proposed the pension reform have said it would not apply to state troopers.
Well, there are several different versions of the bills that are out there.
Right.
Obviously, from a recruitment standpoint, that would be something that I would hope would happen, because we do get applicants from all over the country and from a lot of other departments that are police officers. They have that passion, but they're also looking for their financial security and security for the future.
And clearly, Robin's interested in that. So, Robin, what would you bring to the job? Why are you interested in being a state trooper, if I may ask?
Well, I will tell you, I am a state trooper.
Is that a trick? What's going on here, Robin? Is that the example of the undercover work that you do?
No, I work with Corporal Carpenter. I'm very passionate about being a member of the department, and you know, I figured he would get it out there, but I just wanted to ask. It is a great profession, and I would encourage anyone to do it.
How long have you been doing it, if I may ask?
20 years.
20 years.
Yes.
So you've had a good long time to decide whether this is for you, and clearly it is.
Yes, it is. I mean, every profession has its ups and downs, but every day is a new day, and I enjoy being able to give back to the community. That's why I do it.
Well, we're glad that you do, and we're glad that you called in. Thank you so much, Robin.
You're welcome.
Mr. Carpenter, the state trooper applicants, are fewer of them meeting the requirements, the physical requirements, and as far as the classroom requirements go?
In the process, probably the biggest challenge that the applicants face is the polygraph in the background. A lot of people are making choices right now that they don't necessarily disqualify them for life, but they may set them back several years. The physical requirements, I think a lot of folks are meeting simply because the bar has been set so low. But that, you know, the academics in the classroom and things like that, very few people, once they're there, that are dedicated, that have prepared mentally and physically, have a problem at the academy. It's normally the folks that do not prepare that have the problems.
Sterling on Twitter says, a lot of the problem is that they don't allow tattoos below the shoulder. I wasn't able to proceed due to that. So there's a rule about tattoos?
We do have a policy about tattoos. And the current policy is that there is nothing that is visible from the short sleeve dress shirt down. So what happens, you may apply with a tattoo. However, if you go to the academy and you were told you'll get a uniform shirt that they'll put on you with the physical readiness test, and they'll document the tattoos that you have, they'll look at it, they'll tell you if it meets our requirements or not. If it does not meet our requirements, they'll tell you that it has to be removed. And then it's up to the applicant to decide if they want to get it removed or not. So they can go ahead and proceed through the process, and then they have to make a conscious decision on what they're going to do.
And it's not as though tattoos aren't popular. It seems like every other person has them, particularly depending on your age. So I could see where that would also pose a challenge. 412-246-2002. Let's go to Jerry in Pittsburgh with a question. Jerry, welcome.
Hey, good afternoon. Corporal, thanks for your service. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, sir.
I'm asking a general question about law enforcement through your experience. It has nothing to do with my being interested in the career. I'm over the age, but it seems to me the last couple of years of news coverage events that have had tragic endings have probably shaken the confidence that the public may have in law enforcement, and maybe caused law enforcement or candidates for law enforcement to rethink their career opportunities. And the one thing in particular that I'm interested in hearing you speak about is this issue of control and authority, some might call it power, because it's an awesome responsibility to protect public safety, and an awesome responsibility and a scary one at times to have control over situations or lose control. And I just wonder if you could speak from your experience about this issue of control and authority. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.
Well, we have to be in control. You're right. It is a tremendous amount of responsibility that we have to go out and protect the public. And that's why we screen the candidates the way we do. Everything is done at the academy is done to challenge and push people so that we know we can have a gauge of how they're going to react. You know, many of the things that are out there are individuals, and they paint law enforcement with a broad brush.
And Jerry mentioned about an age, the age, apparently he's over the age. What is the limit as far as somebody that maybe is thinking, I'm ready to change careers. I'd like to apply to be a state trooper and go to the academy. Let's say somebody who's 45 wants to do this. Where do they fall?
Well, if they're 45, they miss the boat. You have to be appointed to the academy prior to age 40. So that means that you have to go to be appointed to the state police academy to report prior to your 40th birthday. Our selection process takes about 7 to 9 months, and that's from the time you take the written exam, not from the time necessarily that you apply. So approximately 7 to 9 months, then you have to wait for your academy date. We have a list that's established, a ranking, and we take X number of candidates per class, and so you have to be appointed prior to. So you need to leave some time, probably 38. If you're 39, you'd really be pushing it to try to get in.
Mm. Katie on Twitter asks, there are psychological studies that state that polygraph tests are only 25% accurate. Has the police force looked into these. And again, you give a polygraph test to applicants. So she's saying, well, gee, what if I go and I fail the polygraph test because they're not very accurate? What about that? Have you addressed that or looked into it?
Well, the department, I mean, lots of departments use the polygraph. And if it was not a useful tool, we wouldn't use it if it was not effective. Nothing's 100%. But, you know, we do an in-depth background to go with that polygraph. And so, therefore, if there's something that could be sketchy, we can follow that up and make sure that, things are, you know, the way they're supposed to be. But it's a very effective tool. If it wasn't, obviously we wouldn't use it. Our polygraph operators, they're full-time. That's what they do. Their troopers do it full-time, and they're trained very well. People think that because of your nerves and things like that, not many people have taken a polygraph. I never took one before I showed up for the state police. I was nervous. We ask a series of baseline questions, and then we find out where the applicant's at as far as, you know, their response, how they're doing that day. Then we ask other questions, and we see how they deviate from that. So it's an effective tool, and I would venture to say that it's a lot more effective than 25%.
We've been talking with Corporal Brian Carpenter of the Pennsylvania State Police about the openings, hundreds of them, that the state police are trying to fill and are encouraging people to apply for. And you said this was just your second live radio interview and that you were a little nervous about this, right?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Okay. Well, it's nice to make a state trooper nervous for a change instead of not that I have been pulled over a lot, but it has happened once or twice. So it's been a pleasure meeting and talking with you. Thank you so much for coming in and joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
You bet. Again, Corporal Brian Carpenter of the Pennsylvania State Police has been our guest. Coming up, our summer road construction projects making your life a living hell. Pardon the tabloid teaser, but we'll look at a construction project underway in the city and address whether its effect on the neighborhood could be minimized. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It's a fact of life in this town. Somewhere in the city, especially at this time of year, something is under construction. And no matter where you live or where you're headed, you are going to encounter the dreaded detour, taking you, depending on how heavy the traffic is, minutes, if not hours, out of your way. One of those ambitious projects causing headaches and nightmares for some is a $12 million road reconstruction project for the corridor of Baum Boulevard, Bigelow Boulevard, and the Bloomfield Bridge between Moorwood and Heron Avenues. Construction is underway. Detours are in place. While PennDOT says it is doing all it can to minimize the disruption for businesses and residents of the area, those who live and work there feel their concerns aren't always taken into consideration when the planning for these projects is done. I'm joined now in studio by Mark Noble, who is on the board of directors of the Polish Hill Civic Association. Mark Noble, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Why, thank you. Happy to be here.
And also with us by phone is Dan Cessna. He's district executive for PennDOT. Dan Cessna, good to have you back on the program.
Good to be with you, Paul.
If you have a comment or question for our guests, you can call 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Mark Noble, let's start with you. What concerns have you been hearing from your neighbors in Polish Hill about this most recent construction project, which just got underway last week?
Well, there are two. The first is one that really doesn't involve disruption. I mean, we understand that roads have to be reworked and that disruption will happen. But we're really sad that we haven't seen any planning go into improving the pedestrian and bike access. This intersection that's being worked on, the Bloomfield Bridge and Bigelow, is really the gateway from Polish Hill, from the Eastern Hill, aka Sugartop, to Oakland. It's really critical. And it's a lot of thought has gone into that intersection with our community plan. Bloomfield's community plan, city transportation planning, and it all centers around a real resurgence of interest in pedestrian and bike access. And there doesn't seem to be any new thinking. We have a $14 million project here, and I don't even think the sidewalks are being repaired, you know, along here. It's just resurfacing a road. And I think that is just a real fail on the part of PennDOT planning.
So you had wanted to see sidewalks expanded and bike lanes put in or expanded?
That would be great. Just some sort of thinking about what is really vital to our neighborhood. Polish Hill is right in the middle of everything. And that is kind of a curse because everybody cuts through it. Everybody, it's transportation for a lot of people. But it is also a real asset to our community that it is right in the middle of everything. It's right in the middle of the medical centers. It's right above the Strip District. It's right near Bloomfield. It's right near super hip Lawrenceville. And it all involves, there are a lot of choke points, and a huge choke point is the Bloomfield Bridge.
So, Dan Cessna, what are the factors that PennDOT takes into consideration when you embark on a project like the Baum Bigelow reconstruction? Is in this day and age when people want to see bike lanes and encourage pedestrian traffic, is that taken into consideration, or is it simply not feasible with something like this?
It's a good question. There's a lot of considerations that are taken into account on projects like this. What we did look at on the Baum Boulevard, Bigelow Boulevard project is normally in an area like this, our intent is to improve the surface condition, which in most cases we would just mill and resurface. But as folks know, this is old busted up concrete, and in one section it is asphalt also. It required actually tearing up the road and doing full reconstruction, and we discovered that through our process that was going to really be the only option to fix the surface. We're really constrained by space. As the gentleman mentioned, this is a tough location. It is a choke point, and it's similarly for us. We did look certainly at the intersections. We will be improving pedestrian connections, updating all of the traffic signals to the latest and greatest for appropriate crossings, ADA accessibility, and those sorts of improvements. But like some other tight corridors in the city, this one with four lanes tucked carefully between the hillside and the sidewalk on the edge, there simply wasn't available capacity to add additional lanes, whether it would be for bike or changed access for pedestrians.
So Mark, as you hear Dan Cessna laying that out, I mean, is part of the problem one of, and it may just not be anybody's fault, but one of an older infrastructure in the city, narrower streets in an older city like ours that I think, you know, when it was built, there were no cars. There were horses and buggies. So the city was designed that way. The streets oftentimes are narrow and can't be expanded. So you're kind of tilting your head to the side as though that may not necessarily be the case.
I think there's a little room for expansion. It would take some fill and some support of a hillside or a little bit more removed from another hillside. But I just don't think there was any thought. I mean, there wasn't any real thought given to doing that. As far as I understand, the sidewalks are not even going to be repaired. Is that correct?
That is right. PennDOT does not own the sidewalks in this area. We will be making adjustments at the intersections where we are doing ADA enhancements. But typically on projects like this, we do not replace the sidewalks that are the responsibility of the property owners.
So clearly, Dan Cessna, the concerns of the residents in Polish Hill and other areas affected by this project, one being that the sidewalks be repaired, that's not going to happen. So I guess another question might be, do you feel PennDOT is doing all it can to assess and listen to the concerns of the residents in the areas affected?
Well, we do in many cases. I mean, I can point to some examples just across the river and East Ohio Street where we recently led a project that we are able to enhance pedestrian connections with some careful reconfigurations of the lanes, changes to the intersections. It isn't possible in every location, and that is an area where we had a pretty long dialogue with the community, and we had quite a bit of information that had been shared with us previously. That's not always the case in every neighborhood.
It's the Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking about construction and detours in the city, and specifically the reconstruction project for the corridor of Baum Boulevard, Bigelow Boulevard, and the Bloomfield Bridge between Moorwood and Heron Avenues. Construction underway, detours in place on that project. And we're talking with Mark Noble, who is with a citizens group on the board of the directors of the Polish Hill Civic Association, and also Dan Cessna, who is district executive for PennDOT. And if you have a comment or question, 412-246-2002 is the number to call in the few minutes that we have remaining. How, Mark Noble, what is the impact of these detours? How are they impacting a neighborhood like Polish Hill?
I think it's going to have a really powerful impact on Polish Hill. Polish Hill is already a cut through, as many people know, for people avoiding the light at Heron and Bigelow. And we get a tremendous amount of rush hour cut through in streets that are so narrow, you actually have to pull over and let opposing traffic pass. I'm afraid that with the intersection of Bigelow and the Bloomfield Bridge, that a lot of people are going to be pouring through Polish Hill, and it will gridlock, which I think is super inconvenient for everybody. And I mean, I don't even think emergency vehicles are going to be able to get through. And I think it would be great if PennDOT would give us a hand and liaise with the city and figure out how to handle this.
Dan Cessna, what about that? I mean, are there any alternatives to the detours that are in place, or is it something that...
Actually, this cutting through Polish Hill is not one of their posted detours, but it's because it's an inappropriate detour. But the fact is that people are going to do it in a big way.
So Dan, what about the concerns here for someone like Mark Noble?
Well, again, we are learning of some of these concerns recently. We take them all certainly very seriously, as we know that any time we have a project of this magnitude, it's going to impact the neighboring communities. We will continue to evaluate traffic. Again, we've put one restriction in place so far. We have several restrictions coming over the next week, and we will always look at those locations to see what adjustments or changes that we can make. One thing that we can't do is restrict where people can drive. So people are obviously going to, especially the first few days of any detour, they're going to seek alternate routes just to try to make their own personal commute better. And as the gentleman mentioned, it does can create gridlock in certain areas. We just can't predict exactly where people are going to travel. And typically after a few days of a detour or a restriction like this, traffic does improve. But it's never obviously going to be as good as when the road is completely open.
So we would have to look to the city for traffic control?
We would certainly join you in those conversations. Absolutely.
You know, Dan, when you say that, you know, you're hearing of these concerns, you know, that are coming up now, could some of this have been anticipated sooner?
Certainly some of it. Obviously, we work to involve folks as we develop projects. We don't capture everything. I'll be the first to admit that we certainly don't always think of everything.
Well, it would have been helpful to have a community meeting before the start of construction. The first community meeting that I was aware of was after construction had started. So that really couldn't have contributed to planning, looking into the start of construction.
And certainly this doesn't all fall on you, Dan, but I guess, you know, since you're speaking for PennDOT now, can PennDOT do a better job of being more proactive and engaging in these conversations sooner rather than waiting until construction is nearly or, in fact, underway, then realizing what the concerns of the residents are?
I would be the first to admit in this case we could have done better, absolutely.
Well, hopefully, as this project goes forward over the next year, things will hopefully go as smoothly as they can possibly be expected for the residents affected by this project. I do want to get to an email comment from Audrey, who says, PennDOT ignored Greenfield's request not to clear-cut the underpass, which is Beechwood Boulevard heading west near the parkway entrance. They continued clear-cutting, thus risking flooding and creating ugliness in the middle of our neighborhood. Don't know if you want to address that, Dan, but that's a concern from Audrey, who emailed from Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I've noted that. I'm not certain the specific example, but I'll look into it.
And we have a caller from Squirrel Hill. Jack is on the line. Let's bring Jack into the conversation with Dan Cessna and Mark Noble. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Dan. Kind of an irate citizen here. I've been living on a particular street, Phillips Avenue, between Shady and Beechwood for over 50 years. In the past 3 years, this street has been in horrible condition. And all they do is once in a while they come up with the gravel patches, and the patches last for about 2 or 3 weeks. And then, especially in the cold weather, then there's nothing but gravel all over the streets. This is kind of a vital street because the school buses come in and out in this section. They come. I'm across from Colfax School. And I've called a number of times, and patching doesn't do any good.
Well, let me jump in, Jack, because we're a little short on time. I certainly appreciate your concern here, and I guess just to broaden this, you know, into a more general area for Dan Cessna to address, what does it take for PennDOT to repave a street, and what about Jack's concerns about what's happening on this particular street?
Well, first, I would note, I believe the street he's referring to is a city-owned street, so it wouldn't be under PennDOT's responsibility. So I would advise that he would call 311. I'm assuming that that's what he has done when he's said that he's contacted, I assume, the city. What was your specific question?
Jack is off the line right now.
Paul, you mentioned something about when PennDOT decides to pave
the
street.
Oh, right. How does it decide to go about repaving? Is there sort of a general policy that we should be aware of?
Well, we use a number of factors. We condition rate all of our roads annually, and we use that data to evaluate candidate projects. And then based on the candidate projects, we actually do physical field views and evaluate and prioritize which projects we pave each year. And the city uses a similar approach, but I can speak for the city. I know their budget's much smaller than their needs and similar to PennDOT, maybe in a more extreme case.
Mark Noble, you wanted to respond. We'll let you have the last word here.
Oh, it would just be great, I think, for PennDOT and the city of Pittsburgh to have a richer conversation. The city, especially under the new Peduto administration, which I think is terrific at planning and communicating with communities, perhaps PennDOT and the city of Pittsburgh should be on the same page.
Okay, well, on that note, we have come to time, but I want to thank both of you for taking part in this conversation. Mark Noble, who's on the board of directors of the Polish Hill Civic Association, and Dan Cessna, district executive for PennDOT. Gentlemen, thank you for being on the program.
Happy to be here.
Coming up, 3 bridges, 1 color, no problem, right? Well, not necessarily. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. You'd be hard-pressed to find an architectural symbol more representative of Pittsburgh than its bridges. The steel expanses are prominently featured in photographs and paintings. Lately, there has been a discussion about what color to paint the bridges. Joining us to talk about the future of these iconic Pittsburgh landmarks is Charles Rosenblum, historian, architecture critic, and adjunct faculty member at the CMU School of Architecture. Charles Rosenblum, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me, Paul. I'm glad to be here.
And you, dear listeners, are you happy with the voters' decision to keep the Three Sisters bridges, the Clemente, the Warhol, and the Rachel Carson Aztec gold when they are painted in the coming years? We'd like you to weigh in at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm. And on Twitter at esspgh. Charles Rosenblum, are you happy with the voters' decision in what appears to be a non-binding referendum here to keep the Three Sisters Bridges Aztec gold?
Right. Well, let's see. It almost has less to do with what the color is. I think Aztec gold might be, you know, kind of okay as a possibility. I think there are historic shades that would be better. The issue for me is that they are listed on the National Register of Historic Places. And because of that, we are obligated to have a process through the PHMC, the Pennsylvania Historic and Museum Commission, that determines what is historically appropriate. We're obligated to have that historical process before opening it up to the public. So I think, you know, maybe the historic kind of gunmetal gray-blue, some people might decide they've been Aztec yellow for a long time. But some of these other more varied color choices really probably aren't going to be part of the real consideration, or they shouldn't be for a National Register listed set of bridges.
You would have a problem then with, you're saying at the very least they should be identical, and the idea that we could go with, you know, keep the Clemente gold and make the Warhol silver and the Rachel Carson green is just something that it would be not a good idea, in your opinion.
Right. Well, they should be identical, and it is an opinion, but it's also based on the historic context in which they were built.
What they and what the stipulations are for, you know, that to be part of historic National Registry of Historic Preservation
of historic places, and it's really the Pennsylvania Historic Museum Commission follows the Secretary of Interior guidelines. It's confusing and bureaucratic. But because they are on the National Register and because this project uses federal funds, there has to be a process which considers their historic origins and their what is historically appropriate before making any decisions. And nobody has done that yet. And I think that process, it is definitely necessary. It's certainly welcome. And I think that coming out of an investigation like that, they'll say, well, you know, we could do the original, what is probably sort of gray-blue. Maybe people will say the Aztec gold has been around long enough. But, you know, they were originally intended to be identical, and there's no doubt about that. And that's part of their historic authenticity.
Let's go to Dan in Pittsburgh, who has a suggestion for the Warhol Bridge. Dan, you're on Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, thanks. I think the Clemente and the Rachel Carson Bridge should have stayed yellow for the tradition that exists now of the yellow bridges, but in light of the Supreme Court ruling for gay marriage, I thought it would be really awesome if we saw the Warhol Bridge painted a rainbow array of colors.
Okay, well, it's an interesting suggestion. There are other suggestions. There was someone who I think in a letter to the editor of the Post-Gazette said, let's paint them red, white, and blue. So what about doing these sorts of kind of off-the-beaten-path things, Charles Rosenblum?
I think that we should paint something in a rainbow color. I think that we should paint something in a red, white, and blue color. But they should be things that are not on the National Register, and they should be things that don't have a long-standing historic tradition of being identical. I look forward to lots of celebrations of the gay marriage decision, lots of celebrations of patriotism, but not on National Register-listed structures.
Let's go to Jacob from McKeesport, another person holding out for different colors. Jacob, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. My one thought would be right now when people are coming into the city and they call for directions and they tell me I'm on a yellow bridge, I have a very hard time knowing which bridge they're on, where they should turn at. So if we had a broader diversity of colors, it would be more helpful to giving landmarks and so people know that they're on the right bridge when they're coming into town and get a better sense of where they are in the city.
So,
the bridges.
So there are historic considerations, and then there are logistical considerations like Jacobs, Charles. So what about that?
Right. Well, you know, there are plenty of bridges in and around the city of Pittsburgh that are not listed as designated as historic structures. So I think that that leaves a lot of possibilities open for more lively and artistic, you know, color choices or other means of wayfinding. I certainly, you know, I think that's an important idea and something, you know, that's a good thing to open up to public discussion and suggestion in places where there aren't already procedures in place.
What makes the Three Sisters Bridges unique?
Well, there are a couple of things, really, and the I can maybe better answer that in terms of context, because it wasn't always a value or a set of procedures to think of bridges as artistically appealing structures. That's something that really came about in the beginning of the 20th century, and it started in New York.
Well, wait, okay, but the Brooklyn Bridge is pretty unique and architecturally interesting, and that was the 19th century.
Right, well, and it was finished in 1883.
You're saying that's an exception.
It's an exception because the Williamsburg Bridge, which came right after it across the East River, was being completed around 1902, and that was a bridge that almost everybody, this is something from the newspapers, this is an object of my research, nearly everybody thought the Williamsburg Bridge was kind of terrible looking, and that was the moment where New Yorkers, you know, as a city, as politicians said, we need an art commission to pass aesthetic judgment on these new bridges because the Williamsburg Bridge is so bad. And having the art commission started in New York, and it developed in Pittsburgh with some similar people involved, and that was the early 20th century, and that's when that started to happen.
And what was the original color of the Three Sisters Bridges?
Well, the irony of that is that it is not completely certain. It was probably a kind of gray-blue gunmetal color. The photographs are black and white. The historical record says very little about the color. I've done archival research in the Art Commission, but not in things like the Transportation or Construction Bridge Departments. Not in the construction portions of the bridge departments. I don't know for certain. It's probably gunmetal, sort of blue-gray that was traditional. The next thing to do, and architects suggested this, and it's a good idea, do paint layer analysis that will peel away the historic layers and allow us to know for certain. I would recommend that as a next step, and that will allow us to say more definitively, not just it probably was that gray-blue, but to affirm that definitely.
When were they painted gold? And Olivia on Twitter asks, why is it called Aztec gold?
The Aztec gold, this has been a subject of coverage, and I remember the early 1900s much better than I remember the 1970s, which I lived through. And there's been newspaper coverage on the Aztec gold, and actually coverage on WESA as well, with a Margaret J. Krause story recently. The Aztec gold has been in my personal memory, and I can't tell you the year offhand.
But it's not necessarily a fairly recent change. It could have gone back to the 40s or the 50s or even before that, maybe.
This is a piece of coverage that has been researched and identified, and I'm not remembering it off
okay.
the top of my head. My recollection is it's from the 1970s, but it's on the historical record. The original color has not yet been definitively determined.
We're down to just a few seconds, but you said earlier in this interview that you could see the bridges being identical colors, but of a different shade. What would it be?
Kind of a gray-blue.
You want to go back to what it probably was originally.
I want to follow the historical process and decide between gray-blue and a mild yellow. I want to go through the historical process, and that's the priority.
Architecture critic Charles Rosenblum talking about the Three Sisters Bridges, which citizens have voted to keep yellow. We'll keep following this story. Charles Rosenblum, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We're out of time. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow on Essential Pittsburgh.